This month, we're asking for your support through our premium programs via the Escapist Plus and YouTube memberships. Your support allows us to continue making the content we want instead of chasing algorithms or the latest trends. Plus, you get a bunch of perks like ad-free viewing via the Escapist Plus on our main website, early access on YouTube via YouTube memberships. You can even ask us questions for our Ask the Creators video series. Thanks for all your support, whether it's with these programs or your general viewership. Fade up, and I say, hi there, my name is Jack Packard.
I'm Darren Mooney.
And this week, we are going to talk about Disney ditching the theaters. We will talk about the many Spider-Men of the multiverse and the bitter sweet horror of Bly Manor. That's all I had. Hi, welcome everyone to the Escapist Movie Podcast.
You're a very obliging host.
Boom. I'm a big fan of alliteration. Like, I feel like that's the easiest pun to do, is just be alliterative.
Yeah.
But in any case, Darren, first we're going to talk about Disney. This is something that is coming up a lot here on the Escapist Movie Podcast because we're still in a global pandemic, and this is a perfect opportunity for big distributors, big filmmakers, big content producers like Disney to finally unchain themselves from the chain theaters and say, you know what, we made the pony. We're selling the pony now, too.
We're feeding it into the horse grinder, and you are going to enjoy the sausages that we make from it.
Yes. We're no longer splitting our profits with you greedy theater owners.
As AMC announced that, like, they're not going to survive to the end of year and into early next year, you know,
exactly.
As well. As Regal shuts down its Cineworld locations in you know, in the UK as well. Mm. Yeah, no, not to start with a bit of a downer, but yeah, it's... That Chinese proverb about living in interesting times. We are living in very interesting times.
We are, and it's bittersweet for us, you know, cinema lovers. I love the movie-going experience for all of its ups and downs, but the writing has been on the wall for a very long time for, you know, kind of selling directly to the customers. The subscription model is winning out in every aspect of entertainment. And here's an excuse, like the pandemic, people aren't going to the theater. So here's Disney's finally being able to rip off that Band-Aid. The big news is basically Disney had like a shareholders meeting, a stockholders meeting that said that they were focusing primarily on content for their streaming services. That was their big focus push. Specifically, this came right after they announced a ton of layoffs as far as their theme parks and, you know, live venues were concerned, which made their shares, their stock shares drop significantly. And so they said, no, it's okay. Everything's okay. We're going to make streaming stuff now. And then their stocks
bounced. 5.4% bounce. Yeah.
Bounced right back up, which is, you know, good for Disney, I guess. Like, I don't know how I want to feel about this.
Good for Disney shareholders. Yeah, no, it's a very much a tried and true Disney strategy. I mean, when we started doing this podcast, they announced like Mulan was going to streaming. Mm-hmm. And the announcement of Mulan going to streaming was also coincided with reports that they, you know, that revenues from theme parks were understandably down by some absurd percentage. Mm-hmm. And it's very much an example of Disney trying to get ahead of the narrative in front of the narrative and try and guide the conversation around it, because we are not talking about the layoffs at the theme parks in this section, apart from us mentioning it right now. Mm-hmm. We are talking about the fact that Disney said, no, streaming is the future. Streaming's where we're going. That's what we're going to push ahead with. And it's very, very canny, very clever brand management from Disney. And you're entirely right to say this is exactly what they've always wanted to do anyway. Mm-hmm. And again, you notice that one of the interesting things is that the studios have had a very different reaction to the pandemic. And you can kind of see that in the ways in which they release movies. And obviously, again, for industry nerds like myself, all of the studios, all the big studios have different personalities. So Warner Brothers is the company that will give you God knows how much money and send you to God knows where, as long as you deliver your print on time and on budget. That's why we don't care if you're Christopher Nolan or if you're kind of George Miller or if you're Zack Snyder. We will give you the freedom and you will do what you want with it, and we will release it in cinemas and hope to God that it works. Or, you know, you had Fox for a little while, which was like, we're going to take the unconventional step of making movies for adults and releasing them in autumn. Nobody's going to see them and we're going to get bought by Disney. That's our market strategy. And, you know, Paramount, which are like, we are really, really, really desperately hoping that Tom Cruise will manage to keep us afloat with his franchise films over the next couple of years, because mm-hmm. Star Trek didn't work out for us at all. So like, in the pandemic, you've had this kind of like, this different personality thing emerging, where Universal emerged first and foremost as the bullish ones. Universal were the ones, because again, they'd been the ones 10 years ago in 2010 who'd wanted to do Tower Heist, release Tower Heist on direct-to-video. And cinemas pushed back and said, well, if you do that, we're not going to show any more Universal films. And Universal were like, let's not be rash here. Let's just put that table out away and come back. And literally the moment that theaters closed in the States, Universal were like, by the way, here's all of our movies that were in cinemas when the pandemic hit, and they're now on digital on demand. You can watch Emma. You can watch The Hunt. You can watch The Invisible Man. You can also watch Trolls. Hell, we'll just throw in, was it The King of Staten Island as well, and see if that floats as well. Like, this real enthusiasm from Universal about it. And it seems like that's kind of mellowed a little bit, because since they've renegotiated deals with, I think, Regal and AMC and places like that. So that's Universal's stance. Paramount's stance has been, Jesus Christ, what the hell are we going to do? We need money. Let's offload as much as we possibly can. So like yesterday, the release of like the Trial of Chicago 7, which is the first of the big Netflix contenders, was sold by Paramount. The Lovebirds, starring Camille Nanjiani and Ezra Ray, was also sold by Paramount. You know, Coming to America 2, Coming to America, was also recently sold, but yeah, coming to see what they did there. I like to think that's what took them the like 30 years to make the sequel, was the fact the guys in the room were like, I cracked it.
We just can't figure out how to get two into the title. Wait a minute, it was in front of our noses the whole time.
Let's order Thai. You like Thai, I like Thai. This feels like cause for celebration. But yeah, so that's being sold to that's been sold to Amazon, and we'll be releasing in December as well. Warner Brothers are very much sticking to the theatrical model. They're a very conservative, very old-fashioned studio. So they're saying, let's try Tenet. Tenet didn't work. Okay, let's just not release anything until like 2022, okay?
Right, we're just going to go into full turtle mode, and then we'll release everything later, absolutely.
Yeah, that's kind of like Warner Bros. Approach. And then Disney, as you mentioned, have basically begun emerging into, well, we have positioned ourselves very, very well in this, because Disney Plus has become the third most popular streaming service in the world, behind Netflix and behind Amazon. So when this pandemic hits, we actually have a base from which we can release these directly online, which will benefit our bottom line in the long term, and which we can make money off. Now, you know, they tried it with Mulan. Now, you know, again, nobody knows exactly how well Mulan worked. Right. Let's be absolutely clear here. But like, we can probably gauge that Mulan did not work as well as Disney intended, because all the Marvel movies are still in vague, nebulous, we'll get a theatrical release mode. And the sacrificial lamb that is going next to streaming, as was pointed out last week, which was Soul, is going, but without the premium fee. We're not trying that experiment again. Obviously,
Soul is a weird case, because one, it's an animated, you know, family movie, children's movie.
Yeah.
I know they did something very similar with Onward, which was, you know, one of the last movies released before the pandemic. And then they kind of just shoved it out to Disney Plus early, almost as a gift. Oh, here, have this.
With your €8 subscription, with your $8 subscription.
Exactly. You've already paid for this. Just have it. And so, you know, we have seen animated films, family films do a lot better as far as streaming services are concerned. And so, Soul is a little bit of a different beast as far as that's concerned, I think.
It is. And it's a Christmas Day release as well, which is very, very, very finely calculated on their part as well. And they're having their cake and eating it, because Soul premiered at the London Film Festival digitally as well. So it still gets that kind of, it's still a prestigious release to a certain extent as well. But yeah, you, like, you can see that Disney are very much in the sense of realizing that they are better positioned at the moment than most of their competitors are, in that like Paramount have CBS All Access, which they're going to rebrand as Paramount Plus, because of course they are, because there are no original ideas out there. Warner Brothers have HBO Max, which I assume in a couple of years will get Warner's Plus or something like that. Warner Squared. I'm really hoping they call them Warner Squared.
I think HBO is a better brand, has better brand recognition than Warner Brothers at this point.
But like, the fact is that like, you've got all these studios doing that, but Disney have actually managed, through the fact that they did it quickly, they got there first, and they actually, to be fair to them, the release of Hamilton on streaming gave them a huge boost to their kind of customer base as well. So they are probably the studio that is best positioned to do something like this, to actually come out and say, we are going full throttle kind of streaming mode. And like, what's interesting is that you have the shareholders for Disney. And again, I love that this is now a business slash Bloomberg slash Forbes podcast, but you have like actual,
this is what we have. We can't watch movies anymore, so we can only speculate on business decisions.
I'm really hoping that we have a cool little graph in the corner that just has red lines going up and down. It doesn't matter what they relate to. They're just red lines. It just makes it sound more authoritative, what I'm saying. But you have like activist shareholders, like I think is it Daniel Loeb, who was writing to Disney and saying like, what Disney should be doing for the foreseeable future is withholding the stock dividend, which is typically about $3 billion, and investing that back into creating original content for Disney Plus. Because the goal is that like, the hope is that each Disney, and again, this is so incredibly crass and vulgar, I love it. But the idea is that like, every Netflix subscriber, apparently, according to Business Maths and Calculations, is worth $1,200 to Netflix. That means the average Netflix subscriber in their life will pay the company $1,200. So whether you have, you get it for a month or you drop off, you get it for 6 months, you drop off, that sort of stuff. Or, you know, you live in a household and you share. At Disney at the moment, I think, is worth about $100. The average Disney subscriber is worth $100. They reckon that if they boost, if they quadruple the amount of money that they spend on original content, they could get that up to $500 in a couple of years. And that would conceivably put them in a launching position to compete with Netflix, which is great because it's arguably the only company that can. And again, the dirty little secret here is that like, for all that we talk about Disney being a behemoth and a monster, and it absolutely is a monster in terms of entertainment, but like, actual tech companies like, say, Apple could like buy and sell Disney and ABC five or six times over without like, without like causing a minor blip in their stock price, but like, so there's this real sense of Disney needing to compete on that level or needing to be in there, and there's something very aggressive about that. And it is interesting how much they're going for it. There's no flowery language, there's no we love the theatrical experience. We want our audience members to experience it as safe as possible, as soon as possible. And we really hope that we can get through this crisis together. There's none of that from Disney.
That's right. No, no. It's just, yeah, we get it. We hear you. We're going to streaming. We'll get it. All the streaming. Stay home. We know you're staying home. Yeah. Absolutely.
Well,
and to me, like, the biggest thing, you know, because obviously, like, everyone knows Disney. And everyone knows that Disney has spent the last 15 years gobbling up every other popular intellectual property to make itself even bigger. But to me, reading all of these articles, like, I'm not a theme park person. I'm not a cruise person. I'm not a person that goes to those things. But that was such a huge wing of the Disney empire. Like, they had this whole other realm of them that had nothing to do with making movies, had nothing to do with making content, just like the live experience that has now been kneecapped.
Yeah, and that's it. And then the obvious need to get out in front of that. And the way you get out in front of that is, as you point out, it's not just you and me who pay attention to this. It's like, my parents would also, when they think of Disney, think of the movies more than the theme parks, even though, as you point out, the theme parks are a much bigger part of the revenue, a much bigger part of the experience. Like, again, like, a large part of the pandemic debate. Like, right now you have debates about, like, they're going to lawmakers and saying, well, what if we open Disneyland at like 25% capacity? You know, what if we push to 50% capacity? You can't do this. That sort of stuff. That's where Disney's arguing with legislators at the moment, even as we're arguing over Disney Plus, which is striking because we don't assume that's a large part of the business, and I don't think that a lot of people do. I think a lot of people just kind of gloss over it. It's like a sideshow because we assume that it's secondary, because obviously all of the theme parks are built on all of the properties that are established by the movies or the brands that they purchase or bought. So we assume that it's a secondary, a tributary market. But it's like, no, when you look at the balance sheet, it turns out all that stuff is pretty important. Pretty important.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, yeah. So yeah, no, it is. It's kind of insane when you get that aspect of it there, and you get that sense of like what Disney's movie making actually constitutes in terms of their release. And again, it's fascinating that this is Disney are going whole hog on this, because I would argue that a large part of the reason why cinema is in the state that it is, and again, this is where I put on my crazy conspiracy theorist slash, you know, people are going to say I irrationally hate Disney hat, but like a large part of why the modern theatrical experience is the way that it is, which is based on intellectual property and the value of intellectual property, and the idea that, you know, summer is now no longer just the summer blockbuster season, is no longer just like May, June, and maybe July. It's now like March through October, and also Christmas as well. Right. And a large part of why that is because of Disney's very aggressive kind of population in the market. Disney's the company that has been saturating the kind of schedule with tentpoles, again, through its subsidiary properties. You know, the Star Wars movies at Christmas, for example, the Marvel movies three or four times a year. And as a result, you end up with like Warner Brothers having to compete, Universal having to compete. And so as a result, you end up with a marketplace that is absolutely filled with tentpoles. There is not one weekend in a normal year, this not being a normal year, but not one weekend in like 2017, 2018, 2019, where you don't have a gigantic $100, $200, $250 million movie opening. And like, what's fascinating is that I would argue a large part of that was driven by Disney. And that is also one of the reasons why I think that we are in, why the studios are so horribly, I want to use a nicer euphemism than screwed, but I'm just going to say screwed by the pandemic, which is because the movies you can release on streaming and make a profit on are movies that cost you around $70 million. That's the amount that Apple paid for Greyhound, for example, and they were happy with that. That's the amount that Disney paid for Hamilton, and they were happy with that, for example. That's the supposed budget of the Snyder Cut for HBO, and I assume they'll be happy with that as well.
Yeah.
Like, that's the threshold. You can't release a $200 million movie on streaming and make a profit on it. And I think, I suspect Mulan proves that. But the reason why the studios don't have any $70 million movies lying around is because they stopped making them. It's because the marketplace was so absurdly saturated by these blockbusters that were driven by the intellectual property, kind of like Disney sucking all the oxygen out of the room market. And so I find something like both darkly hilarious and entirely appropriate about the fact that Disney have looked at that and their first response is, well, screw it, we're throwing the board over and we're starting again on the streaming. It's like, that's the future.
We've cracked the code. We finally figured it out. We'll still make our blockbusters, but we'll make them little blockbusters and it'll be all fine. Yeah, and I have a grander theory about that. I think you're absolutely right. I think Disney was kind of the first big studio to kind of gobble up all the properties and, you know, only put out these kind of tentpole blockbusters. I think it started a little bit earlier than that.
Yeah.
I have a unified theory that the reason why we only have remakes and intellectual property and giant blockbusters is actually Kevin Smith's fault, but we won't get into that now.
You would have thought they'd pay him better. You would have thought like he'd have more to show for it, right?
He's still working. He's working. He's making his weirdo movies. He's directing, superhero TV shows. No, I think the really short version of my unified theory of that is that Kevin Smith is the most influential filmmaker of our generation, but our generation didn't make films. We made YouTube videos about films that were mostly about the big properties. Yeah. And so Kevin Smith started the echo chamber of intellectual property. That's the very short.
That makes sense. That's a pretty good idea. That's a solid basis. And that will get you to the late 90s and into the early 2000s, which is where the problem really kicks off. And then obviously you have things like, again, lots of boring stuff. I hope there's a really cool graph in the corner. But lots of little things like the financial crisis, meaning that you don't want to make dozens of little movies when they could fail. You want to make a big movie that everybody has to see. And then that's where we are now.
Absolutely. And so, you know, it's, you know, for me, for someone who I have a family of four here, I have a Disney Plus subscription. You know, this is going to be fine for me because that means me and my kids have something to watch on Disney Plus. For me personally, as a movie fan, that means that, you know, we might see a smaller theater experience. We might see only an art house theater and one multiplex that only shows the big movies in the theaters. And so, like, there's parts of me that I think this will work very well, and there's parts of me that don't like this at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't like change. I'm going to be honest, Jack. I'm afraid of change. No, I mean, I understand that, like, streaming is good for a lot of people, and I'm not at all kind of a Neanderthal who's, like, clinging to the way that it was. Mm. I really like that kind of Netflix exists to fill the gap that it does in making movies that studios no longer make and that sort of stuff. And that Netflix is a company that exists to throw $200 million at making Robert De Niro look like a Call of Duty character. You know, I think I kind of love that that's the market that exists,
yeah,
and that that's possible and wouldn't have been feasible at any time. But I also do, as you point out, like, a good theatrical experience. And to be clear, a good theatrical experience isn't an experience that everybody's guaranteed, particularly at this moment in time. Like, not especially at this moment in time, but like within the last decade, let's say.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like an experience with a projectionist who knows what he's doing. Mm. An usher who's at the door who will eject anybody who's using their phones. A cinema that is perfectly clean. A cinema that serves good food. Customers and fellow colleagues who are there to enjoy the movie with you and not kind of do running commentary over it. And again, you know, that's not an experience that everybody has when they go to their local cinema. But like, if you go to the right cinema, it's a beautiful experience. And I love that. And I will miss that if that goes. And I kind of, particularly for new movies, I think that like seeing a big movie with a big crowd, like, you know, take Endgame, for example, right? If you had watched Endgame by yourself in your room, it probably would have been a good movie. Mm-hmm. But like, you wouldn't have had that moment where Captain America picks up the hammer and the entire crowd goes wild. I mean, maybe you would shout at your... Yeah, maybe you would do that. But I mean, you don't hear you doing that. Like, you don't get the experience of, like, 40 or 50 or 100 or 200 yous doing that simultaneously together.
Hearing the air suck out of the room because everyone gasped simultaneously. Yeah. Oh, it's so beautiful. Or, like for me, of recent experiences, like watching The Last Jedi in the theater, and that moment where Laura Dern goes to hyperspace and smashes through the Star Destroyer, and it's just silent for 10 seconds and everyone is like, what the... That beautiful, stunned silence.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, and like, it's ironic that, like, The Quiet Place 2 was one of the first movies affected by it, and it hasn't got a release on streaming yet, because, like, one of my favorite cinematic experiences of going to a cinema was watching The Quiet Place and watching the audience get, like, complicit in the hook of the movie, because it's like, when they're creeping round, like, normally you can hear people munching popcorn or whispering to their friends, but when you're watching The Quiet Place on a big screen, everybody in the cinema is quiet. Like, you can look around, you can see somebody has, like, a little popcorn kernel in their hand, and is, like, almost afraid to put it in their mouth because the monster might hear it. And, like, that is an incredible experience, and it's kind of like, I like that, like, The Quiet Place 2 hasn't gone to streaming, because I might get to do that again, time with Cillian Murphy, you know?
Yeah, I think that's great. This is, as we're talking about Disney, this is a nice little segue, because I feel like we've wrapped up that conversation, and so I'm segueing over to Spider-Man, who's now... Oh, you save that popcorn, because people just listening to the podcast didn't see you hold up that fake popcorn kernel to your mouth. Spider-Man news... There's lots of weird news, and then lots of debunking of the news, and then lots of, well, they're not really debunking the news. Here's what we know for sure. They are making a third Tom Holland Spider-Man movie. We know for sure it's the same director as the first two, and we know for sure that Jamie Foxx is returning as Electro. It's electrifying, you know, even though Jamie Foxx says he won't be blue in this one, which coded language, we don't know. So that's what we know for sure. We also know that Benedict Cumberbatch is in the Spider-Man 3. We don't know why. Then we started to hear rumors that Andrew Garfield and Tobey Maguire are also going into be the music. Oh, it's a multiverse. It's a Spider-Man multiverse. It's all the things that all the people want. Let me get this verbiage correct here. I have the official, like, non-statement.
I love that we have a style guide for talking about Spider-Man. It's like, is the hyphen in the right place? That's the most important question.
First of all, everyone just says Spider-Man as one word. It's Spider-Man, and I do wish that people would get that together. Okay, where is our official quote from Disney here? Let's see here. I want to make sure I get this right, because it's very much a non-denial. Right. Yeah. Okay. Those rumored castings are not confirmed. That was the studio's denial, which is, I mean, like, which is...
I love that. If only there were somebody who could confirm them or deny them even, and if only it were the person making this statement, or corporation or conglomerate.
Okay. Right, well, and that's a little bit of them wanting their cake and eating it too, yeah. Because if they're not involved, they didn't deny it. Ooh, people get excited. And if they are involved, they denied it and people are getting excited. And so they get it both ways. For me... you know, Spider-Man is one of my favorite fictional characters of all time. I really, really love Spider-Man. I love the Tom Holland Spider-Man movies, in fact, more so than the Tobey Maguire ones. We don't really talk about the Andrew Garfield ones, which I know for someone my age is almost sacrilegious to like the Tom Holland ones more than the Tobey ones, but I like their tone better. I like Tom Holland being younger. I think they've fit more closely to the Spider-Man that I love. But the Tobey Maguire ones, aka the Sam Raimi ones, were the thing that kicked off the modern generation of superhero films. And so even just a nod, even Tobey Maguire flicking on screen for 1 second in the Spider-Man suit, we go, ah, look at him
dancing down the street with his little like emo perm.
Like just seeing Into the Spider-Verse,
yes.
Seeing the animated version of that filled me with nostalgic joy. Yeah.
We don't talk about that.
And so, like, to me, even if it is a very small cameo, just a wink and a nod to the Raimi ones as we're flying through the multiverse, because we can only assume that multiversal things are happening, I'll love that. I've seen, like, rumors that... like the Andrew Garfield Spider-Man and the Tobey Maguire Spider-Man are going to like swing in to help Tom Holland Spider-Man defeat a group of interdimensional villains. And I do not want them to be a big part of the movie.
can I, like, this is the thing where I like Tom Holland. I think Tom Holland is incredibly charming. I'm not a huge fan of the two most recent Spider-Man movies. And a large part, I know, hottest take. They are still better than the Garfield movies. Don't worry, it's not that hot a take.
There we go.
And, like, a lukewarm take. But, like, I like Holland. I think that there's a lot of charm in them. I think that particularly the first one does, like, the John Hughes high school stuff very well. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of, like, a nice kind of mode for Spider-Man to be in. My big problem with them is the weird insistence on making them like Marvel Studios movies, if that makes sense, in terms of making them, taking away what, and again, you mentioned that like what you like about Spider-Man is in the Tom Holland movies. And what I like about Spider-Man as a concept, and it's not necessarily a continuity thing, it's just like a general tone and mood thing, is the idea that Spider-Man is a literal working class hero. He's strange and he's odd and he's on the outside. He's a little kid who's dealing with these things that are absolutely impossible and beyond, like, you know, his capacity to deal with. And he has nobody to help him. And, like, generally, it's like the X-Men. Like, if you're doing an X-Men story properly, like, the rest of the Marvel Universe have to seem like assholes. If you're doing a Spider-Man movie properly, the rest of the Marvel Universe has to seem like assholes. Like, you have to believe that Captain America or Iron Man really don't care about this, like, teenager who's gonna dancing around on rooftops. Mm-hmm. And one of my big issues with, you know, Homecoming and Far From Home is that they try to retrofit the Spider-Man formula for an MCU age, where you basically have, and I like the two villains in isolation, but you basically take two of Spider-Man's most iconic villains, the Vulture and Mysterio, and you make them Iron Man villains for some reason. And you also make Peter Parker, whose like defining attribute is that he's a kid who's struggling with money, who's holding down several jobs at the same time and dealing with the weight of being a superhero and doing all this on his own back and his own initiative without any support framework whatsoever. And like, give him an Iron Man costume and a butler and a fighter jet. And it's like, I feel like at some point you've maybe moved a little bit too far from like from what I want personally. And, you know, and again, like, if you want to point to continuity, you can say like the J.M. Straczynski run, and it's obviously drawn from that, or Bendis's New Avengers. There's obviously like canon and continuity that supports it. Canon and continuity for everything.
Yeah, that's
exactly. But I mean, like, what I like about a Spider-Man movie is that it's small, it's intimate, and it's personal. Mm-hmm. And like, when you're all of a sudden going to like Hughes, presumably, from what we can gather or infer from the rumors, speculation, and casting confirmation, where you're going to use a Spider-Man movie to serve as a nexus. If, you know, not the nexus, because Doctor Strange 2 Multiverse of Madness is presumably going to open the door, and then Spider-Man 3 is just going to swing right through it. But if you're going to use it as a nexus for this multiversal stuff going on there, it feels like it's like you're using the property as a gateway for larger brand management rather than to tell its own stories. Like, I understand why you'd want to do a multiversal Spider-Man story in that, like, you know, I'm sure people like the Andrew Garfield movies. You know, I'm magnanimous enough to say I'm sure there are fans.
I'm sure someone
them.
Does,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. Logically, someone has to. Emma Stone, probably. I don't know. But no, I mean, seriously, like, I'm sure there are people who like them. The Tobey Maguire movies are a touchstone for an entire generation of comic book fans. Mm-hmm. And there's a reason why you can do that with those characters and you can't do it because there's no previous version on screen of Iron Man. Like, as much as you and I might love the 1990s version of Captain America, I really don't want to see a multiversal version where Chris Evans and well, I kind of do now that I mention it, want to see the kind of crossover the Roger Corman version.
Where Chris Evans, like, meets, what was his name? Salinger's kid, right?
Yeah.
It was, what was his name? I forget his first name. From the Captain America movies.
Yeah.
We're going to just call him Tommy. Salinger.
Tommy Salinger.
That would be really funny, though.
It would be really funny, but I'm not sure you could get a blockbuster movie out of it. Whereas you can do that with these. It's much like, say, bringing Michael Keaton into Flashpoint, where it's like you have, like, because there have been so many iterations of Batman, you can say to audiences, oh, hey, here's an old Batman you like, here's an older Batman you like, here's a new Batman. And that way, then, when we introduce new Batmans and cast changing, and when Robert Pattinson decides that he's done after three movies, we can just tag him out and swap him out and not have to explain it to you and keep the kind of, like, the continuity going or whatever, keep the shared universe going and your brand investment. So I understand why, from a practical point of view, Spider-Man is the character with which you do that. And I also understand that, like, Into the Spider-Verse was fantastic and brilliant and worked beautifully, and why you might look at that and say, yeah, but let's do that in live action with actors and brand recognition. And, like, the kids love Tobey Maguire,
he's a meme. The kids love that meme.
Yeah. But, like, I can see why, from a business point of view, you do that. But it's just, it feels like it's been since 2000, and I want to say, what, 2 or 4 since Spider-Man 2, since I've had, like, a proper Spider-Man movie. Okay, arguably, like, it's Into the Spider-Verse. Into the Spider-Verse is a great Spider-Man movie. But, like, live action wise, you have to go back to Raimi's Spider-Man 2 to say I've had a proper, like, no
that's
frills.
That's a good one.
Yeah, it is. It's a hell of a great one.
That's a great one. And, like I'll agree with what you're saying here. Like, I think Spider-Man Homecoming is definitely more of a very Spider-Man movie, even though he has, like, access to, like, the big boys. The big boys willfully ignore
activating
him.
Kill mode.
Right. Oh, super fun. But you know, like, it's still him, like, in over his head, learning, wanting to be bigger than he is. And I think that fits the Spider-Man ethos. I agree with you wholeheartedly on Far From Home, where, like, literally the point of the story is Peter Parker finding his own way to do things, and he does that by building an Iron Man suit on a jet being flown by his butler, which completely undermines the fucking point of the story. Absolutely. Like, I'm with you. I'm with you 100%.
I mean, like, there's arguably never been, like, a better metaphor for, like, what it's like being swallowed by the Marvel Cinematic Universe than Spider-Man Far From Home, which largely consists of Spider-Man saying, I don't want to be in an MCU movie, and Sony saying, you're going to be in an MCU movie. You're going to cross the... There's going to be talk of multiverse. You're going to have a butler. There's going to be a cameo from Samuel Jackson. You are not going to have a small, intimate, personal adventure which possibly has romantic comedy undertones. You are going to save the universe whether you want to or not, young man.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And so, I understand how all of that can relate to the new Spider-Man 3, and unlike the old Spider-Man 3...
Which also probably had too many characters thrown together, to be fair.
Also had too many characters. Yeah. I guess I can see, and I really hope, like, hearing you talk about how the new Spider-Man 3 might be a reaction to the sudden and unsuspected success of Into the Spider-Verse, which I like. Into the Spider-Verse was its own unique thing. Sony did all they could to bury it, and it was still, you know, huge, and everyone loved it. And so I really hope that this isn't a reaction to that. Like, oh, we can do that with our own Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah.
That would be absolutely terrible. So now, please don't do that.
What if we did the same thing, but we took out all of the stuff that made it like a great, lovable, fun movie with a lot of heart and shoved in like brand recognition? Yeah, how would that work for you?
That'd be great. Yeah. That'd be great.
Promotions all around. I'm ordering some Thai food. Yeah. It's like...
Right. So let's just hope we have some tiny cameos and it's still... I think Theming is really important to me, especially in genre pictures. And if you look at Spider-Man Homecoming, you know, this theme of basically like Spider-Man wanting to skip ahead in the queue, right? Like it was him like, oh, I'm grown up. I'm definitely grown up. And at the end of the movie, oh, I'm actually not grown up. I'm going to stay small. Like that, the beautiful, perfect theming.
As he wrestles with a jet that flies through the air and crashes in Coney Island.
Still?
From Avengers Tower. I know. I'm being. Yeah,
you're being snide. I see. I'm still going along with the theme. It's a small thing. It's just him, and he's in his like, he's doing it with his homemade underoos costume. So I think it definitely counts.
Okay.
Far From Home. That theming gets hella muddled, if I can, you know, use the lingo of the children. And to me, all of the MCU movies, like the good ones for me are the ones with a strong theme and all of the action sequences follow through on that theme. I hear what you're saying and I know you're right and I just don't want you to be is basically my point.
To be fair, I'm also just being a curmudgeon-y old grump, to be fair. It happens on occasion. There are lots of things that I like. Like, as much as I complained about the fact that they turn, like, the Vulture and Mysterio into Iron Man villains, and despite the fact that I feel like that squanders maybe, like, the best part of Spider-Man, where Spider-Man has, like, one of the best rogues galleries in comics, so why would you turn them into second-rate Iron Man villains when Iron Man has, like, one of the worst galleries in comics? It's like, guys in suits, guys in armor... guys in suits who employ guys in armor. Those are our three types of Iron Man villains. Thank you very much. But like, again, I say that, but I still really liked, like, I would argue that like Michael Keaton's Vulture and Jake Gyllenhaal's Mysterio are probably two of the top tier MCU villains. Like, and I, that's...
100%.
Yeah. And like, well, I genuinely love that. Like, again, Gyllenhaal's performance is a delight. As much problem as I might have with the movie around it, the sequence where Gyllenhaal's complaining about the special effects in his little mini movie is just, like, beautiful. Because that was the moment where I was like, okay, I see what you're doing here, movie. I can get on board.
Well, no, and, you know, for Spider-Man, for those of us who like the Spider-Man comics, any of his best villains are, and really, I guess this goes with any comic book hero, any of their best villains are just dark reflections of their own insecurities. Or of their own selves, and I think both Vulture and Mysterio are great within the MCU universe of being like a reflection of either Peter Parker not being recognized like by the big boys, just like Vulture was, or Mysterio, you know, wanting to create his own way of doing things, much like Peter was trying to do, or shirk responsibility, or whatever theme you have. And we don't know who the villain of Spider-Man, new Spider-Man 3 is going to be, Gret.
I look forward to Jamie Foxx becoming an Iron Man villain. He's not going to be blue. He's going to be red and gold. That's the twist.
He's going to have an electric suit? Oh, no. I mean, you might be right.
No, I'm
it's
not
much
right.
Easier. It's much easier to do suit special effects than to turn him blue.
Yeah. I love that that's the big note they got from Amazing Spider-Man 2. Other movie great, but quick note, maybe Jamie Foxx shouldn't be blue, ? And it's like, well, if Mark Webb had taken that note, we'd be living in a very different universe.
Actually, but they gave Rhino an Iron Man suit in Amazing Spider-Man 2, so...
And like, you know, I have a certain soft spot for Amazing Spider-Man 2, which is not a good movie, but my soft spot for it largely resides in the fact of Paul Giamatti clearly having the time of his life. And, like, if you go on YouTube and you look at interviews around Amazing Spider-Man 2, look at Paul Giamatti discussing, like, Amazing Spider-Man 2, and he loves it so much. And he talks about it, and he talks about it in a way that I kind of want to imagine as him parodying himself, where he's like, so I think about my process as an actor. I'm playing the Rhino as my character. And the great thing about the Rhino as a character is it's very easy to get in his headspace. You always know what he wants. Like, so I come up to a wall. I don't want to get through the wall. What do I do? Well, I charge through the wall. That's what I do. So I come to a door. Door's locked. How am I going to get through this door? Well, I charge through the door. It's like, and I kinda, I love that Paul Giamatti's like, yep, I cracked the Rhino as a character.
You know, I really, like, I got into his head and I really just sat there and thought about it. And it was mostly about breaking walls and stuff. Pretty great. And, like, smashing stuff. It was pretty neat.
Like, who cares for complexity and nuance? It's like, nope. I see Spider-Man. I don't like him. What am I going to do?
That's the great thing about Rhino as a character. There's no complexity there. He's just he's just a big dude who likes to smash stuff. So I like that. All right. Let's move on to the big talking point. We're going to try to be as spoiler-free as we can for at least the first part of this. When we start talking about spoilers, we will let you know. But The Haunting of Bly Manor, the newest iteration, season two, if you will, of the Haunting series, of their spooky anthology stories about a big, spooky, haunted house.
I love that this is our hook. I love that it's like, okay, so what are we going to do with three? Is it going to be a haunted skyscraper? No, haunted bunker. That's what it's got to be.
Why not? It doesn't matter. It's a big haunted space. A genre that I love unabashedly and without any pretense is people dealing with their personal trauma, but also there's actual ghosts. I love that. I'm a big fan of that. Like, I'm dealing with something personal, but there's also something spooky happening. Ooh, give it to me all. Yeah. Give me all of it.
The ghosts are a metaphor, but they're also ghosts.
But they... There's some of each, but there's also ghosts. That's the important part, is there has to be actual ghosts. And so, like, for anyone who watched and really enjoyed The Haunting of Hill House, here we have The Haunting of Bly Manor. A lot of the same cast returns. It's the same production team. I'm trying to think, is this also based off of books by the same author? I don't know.
Not by the same author. The Haunting of Hill House is based on Shirley Jackson's book. The Haunting of Bly Manor is based on stories by Henry James, the most obvious one being The Turning of the Screw. But, and again, without getting too spoilery, within particular episodes, they draw from other particular short stories. And in fact, episode 8, they kept the title of episode 8 a secret because it's based on a particular Henry James story that they didn't want to reveal ahead of time. So it's kind of drawn from his whole kind of oeuvre of work, which is quite cool.
Oh, very nice, very nice. And I guess most importantly is the showrunner is the same. It's
Mike Flanagan,
right? And it's tonally, it's very, very similar. It's significantly more emotional than I was personally prepared for than Haunting of Hill House, but it also has a creepy atmosphere. There are spooky things happening. It's a bit of a mystery how those spooky things work. And it's just delightful. It's especially like, for a binge watch. I know you suggested that we do this for the Escapist Movie Podcast because you got an early screener of it. You saw it weeks ago. But it finally came out to Netflix, and I said, oh, you know what? I'll watch a couple episodes, and I'll be able to talk about it. And you get to episode 3 and 4, and you said, no, I have to watch every single episode.
It's great. It's like heroin. It's like as a metaphor, like the Haunting of Hill House is like this recurring theme of addiction that runs through it, which, you know, is obviously a very heavy, very serious theme that the show handles with a great deal of respect and nuance and deserves a lot of credit for it. But it also feels entirely appropriate for a movie that is going, as for a show that's going to be delivered through the binge watching mechanism, which is like, yes, I would like the next episode now, please.
Give it to me now. Yeah. Give it to me now. Do I have time to watch it right now? Because I'll watch it right now. I don't care if I stay up late. I'll watch it now. And so it's you know, especially for those of us who like horror movies, it's a beautiful atmosphere. I would like to submit to you, Darren, a counterpart to the Netflix bloat, which we often complain about. A positive counterpart, the yin to the bloat, is the Netflix amble.
Ooh.
Which is, in their series, they get to take their time and they get to be very slow, and you can have extended sequences where the creeped out babysitter is slowly walking through the creepy house and noises happen, and you don't need to cut to commercial and you don't need to cut it for time because you just let it amble, baby.
Yeah. Oh, no, absolutely. Like, I think one of the things that separates Flanagan's output, The Haunting of Hill House and The Haunting of Bly Manor, from the bulk of other Netflix shows is, and again, this is where I put on my grumpy old man TV critic hat, which I have right just over here. But I keep it off stage just for situations like this. But they, other Netflix shows tend to not really respect the idea of the TV episode, because you're going to watch it as like 2 4-hour movies, or, you know, mm-hmm. a 4-hour movie, a 5-hour movie, or 3 4-hour movies. You're going to watch it in a binge. You may even just pause an episode when you're done and come back to it 3 or 4 hours later. What I really like about Flanagan's work is that he structures his shows so that episodes are still important, even though they are, as you mentioned, incredibly bingeable, which is a rare talent. So what you have is you have episodes that are built around specific characters and like exploring specific characters part of the story as well. Because I think what's interesting about The Haunting of Bly Manor is you get a lot of the information about what's happening in the first two episodes, and then you get 3 episodes after that that are largely just, okay, but what about this side character's experience of the stuff that you already know? Or how does this other person fit into what you already know? And it's a very, as you point out, it's the ambling kind of way around it, where it's like, you know, if you were rushing, you would cut all that stuff, or that stuff would be unessential, or you would prioritize the plotting of it. You'd build towards revelations to keep people going. Like, I feel like Flanagan and his writing staff here, because he didn't write all of it and he didn't direct all of it, because apparently he wrote a lot of Hill House and he directed all of Hill House and he almost killed himself by his own admission. Kind of stepped back into a showrunner role and kind of like let other people do it, which is a healthy way of doing things, but it still feels like a Flanagan Absolutely. Production. But like all of Flanagan's stuff is very trusting of its audience, because it trusts that you will, if the story's interesting and if it's well told and the characters are compelling and the cast is good, it trusts that you as a viewer will generate your own attachment to it, and you will actually care about them, and you will want to spend time with them outside of, well, the puzzle box has to be opened. I have to know, like, what the mystery, I have to solve what's going on in Bly Manor. And you will actually be, as you pointed out, quite happy to just wander around the grounds with the scared babysitter as the floor creaks. Or you'll be happy to spend time with the kind of like the housekeeper who seems slightly off but can't explain why she is. Or the lovely chef and his kind of like weird relationship with his mother, but also his inability to articulate his feelings towards the woman he's clearly attracted to. All this sort of stuff is allowed to kind of play out. Yeah, and it trusts that, like,
you just snuggle up with this, and it's the characters, it's the mystery. This is the anti Damien Lindelof of television, where they actually answer the questions, but also like, so you answer the questions and you care about the characters. It's beautiful. You just snuggle up. Oh, yeah.
I'm going to make you watch The Leftovers, Jack. I'm going to make you watch The Leftovers.
Is it good?
It's beautiful. It broke my little heart, my ickle heart.
No. That's an older reference. It's basically just a lost reference. Maybe we can blame Abrams more than Lindelof.
So it like The Haunting of Bly Manor is beautiful. And like, this is a thing where I'm kind of curious. You really loved The Haunting of Hill House. I've managed to gather from context.
I really enjoyed The Haunting of Hill House, yes.
And this is interesting because I have always generally respected Flanagan's work more than I've loved it. Like, I've always been like, that is a very pretty movie. That is a very clever movie. That is a very well-constructed movie, and it has good themes, and he's put a lot of thought into it, and he understands what he's saying, and he understands where he's coming from, and he understands what the purpose is and why all these elements fit together. Like, it's all clockwork, and I'm like, this is amazing. This is, like, really well-constructed, but it doesn't, like, my heart never melts watching a kind of Flanagan movie, and it always felt like, up until this point, that there was something kind of holding him back. Like, he was almost afraid of being, like, pure, uncut, sentimental, like, romantic. Watching like The Haunting of Hill House, I felt like this would almost be a much better TV show if it wasn't trying to scare my pants off. And to be clear, The Haunting of Hill House like has one of the best jump scares I've ever seen. If you've seen it, you know exactly what I'm talking about. Like, it is a immaculately well constructed the car sequence.
Okay. It's been a while. I saw it last year. It's out of my head.
Obviously, it wasn't that great a jump scare sequence. Okay, fine. But it also has, like, say, Two Storms, which is the episode that's made to look like a series of long takes, which is also incredibly technically impressive. But, I liked it. I didn't love it. What I loved about The Haunting of Bly Manor is that it felt like Flanagan actually took a deep breath and was like, well, actually, all of my stories are about time. They're about loss. They're about suffering. They're about love. Mm-hmm. And that's the subtext. That's what drives everything from Oculus to Dr. Sleep, which is also very good, to The Haunting of Hill House. But, you know, what if I turn down just a little bit, if I turn down the horror in the mix just a little bit, and I turn up this, like, idea that this is a story about love and a story about time and a story about, like, all the stuff that's in all those gothic romances that I love so much. And, like, I think that's maybe why I genuinely love The Haunting of Bly Manor more than I kind of love The Haunting of Hill House, because it's a proper ghost story in the sense of it's a story about what ghosts are, which are this idea of kind of memories and, you know, the things that we don't say, the things that we can't say, the things that we are afraid to say and afraid to articulate, the idea that time might not move for certain people or for certain places, and the idea that while this is terrifying and it's good for a jump scare and it's full of horrific imagery, it's also incredibly sweet and incredibly moving, and as you point out, want to curl up with a warm blanket with it as much as hide behind it, you know?
And, you know, you wonder how much we can attribute that to, as you say, he's been more collaborative with this one. I want to say it's Lori Penny, who was also like a producer and writer on several episodes. I might have that name wrong, though, as I'm just trying to remember all the names during the credit sequence.
Most of the writers, so he only wrote one episode himself. He only wrote the pilot. And I think his brother wrote the second episode, but every other episode has a different writer. And most of them have different directors. There are a couple of episodes that share directors. I think it's kind of broken down. So Kieran Foy directed the second and third. Liam Gavin directed the fourth and fifth. Yolanda Ramka and Ben Howling did the sixth and seventh. We'll come back to the eighth in a moment. And the final one was directed by E.L. Katz. So, like, it is very much kind of like a split collaborative process. I think it's like, I'm fairly sure, like most showrunners and most television producers, he was there in the room guiding everybody and rewriting scripts and reworking scripts and telling you, bring up this bit, focus on that bit. I want this scene to be longer. Can you add this line of dialogue? Can you cut that line of dialogue? Because it does feel like it fits with all his other stuff perfectly. It doesn't feel like it's disjointed or the work of a dozen different hands.
Oh, absolutely. But that collaborative nature could have gotten him out of his own head, where someone was like, hey, what if we pump up the relationships? What if we make our viewers like it's chest tighteningly sad, but you're also scared, which is a thing that happens in The Haunting of Bly Manor. You are scared and crying and just so into it, which is a very strange emotional cocktail for a horror flick. Yes.
Yeah, and I love that about it. And I feel like the fact that it's willing to do that is what makes it special, what I loved about it. Like, rather than it going, no, I've decided you're going to be scared. It's like, I decided you're going to be scared and you're going to be sad. And you might be more scared or more sad at different points, but you're going to be consistently one or the other throughout. And it's like, I really like that because it leans into the themes and the ideas. It feels like a way of approaching stuff that he's approached before, but with a kind of a clarity and a focus that I think pays off. Because I found it genuinely moving in a way that I haven't 100%. Found a lot of film or television this year to be genuinely moving, you know, which is quite impressive.
I 100% agree. I had to binge it. This is something I would normally watch like with my wife after the kids go to bed. But, you know, I binged it because, you know, we were doing it for the show. And, it, you know, it's just me in my office going, oh, you know, like just tears and scared. And it's, you know, but like joyful tears, sad tears. It's the whole spectrum.
You come downstairs afterwards and you ask, was it really that bad?
It's fine. Well, what I will say, like, you know, because obviously, like, I think overall it's a fantastic series. One of the issues I definitely had with it specifically in the pilot episode is it is overwritten to hell. I don't know if you've noticed that, like, but some of the lines of dialogue, it felt like an SNL sketch where the actor was reading it off of a cue card and had not internalized it. It was rough. It's a bit of a rough start.
There's a lot of, like, dialogue as theme, you know? There's a lot of, like, in case you don't get the subtext of what we're talking about, we're going to spell it out using an extremely literal metaphor. And I say this as somebody who, like, I will admit, I grew up on, like, Chris Claremont X-Men comics. I have a huge fondness for purple prose and unnecessary level of detail in your dialogue. There's a sequence in one of the episodes, without getting too spoilery, where the gardener takes a character out into the middle of the night on the estate and takes her out to see a moonflower. And in case, listeners, you don't know what a moonflower is, a moonflower only blooms once and then its petals fall out. And isn't that what makes it beautiful? You know, like life. Or people, or basic existence. The fact that it's impermanent. And in case you don't get that, I have a gigantic metaphor about, like, coal being in the ground, compressed hatred and sadness and bitterness, mm-hmm. and rising up and burning again. And this monologue is going to go on for 10 minutes. And it's going to be fantastic, to be absolutely clear. But it's like, it's very much like, in case you don't get what this show is about, we are going to literally direct a monologue to the camera. And we do that, like, episode 8, which I love. I think episode 8 is one of my favorite episodes of television of the year so far. But episode 8 is very much like Carla Guccino playing the narrator, because, of course, it's all of Flanagan's favorite, like, actors over and over again, is going to narrate to you about the concept of time and memory.
Like, oh, right. Like, this is an old stage theater production, and, like, it's a soliloquy. Yeah. The spotlight goes on the actor, and the actor is looking directly in the eyes of the audience to go, I'm going to tell you all about my character backstory now and how that affects me as a person today. But there's also this prop that we have that also highlights it, just in case he can't hear me in the back. Let's go.
Yeah. I get that it's overwritten. I kind of adore that, because I kind of, like, adore that kind of, like, just go for it chutzpah. It's like,
sure,
because it's a genre piece, and one of the things that I like about genre pieces is that, because, you know, people tend to brush over genre, they don't treat it as serious or as weighty as other kind of genres. Like, horror in particular tends to go, here's the metaphor. Here it is. Like, you know, as long as it's just shy of really makes you think, doesn't it? I generally tend to, like, get on side with it, because I'm like, okay, fine. In case there was any ambiguity about how I, as an audience member or critic, might interpret this, I really appreciate you taking the time to spell it out. But and the fact is, the actors are great, and the production is fantastic. And it's that flip side of the Netflix bloat where it's the kind of thing where if you were making a horror movie, that would be the first stuff you would cut. You screen it for an executive, and it's like, do we really need the 10 minutes about moonflowers? And it's like, that's note number one.
We got to get this down to 90 minutes. Cut the moonflowers. Cut the slow amble in the haunted house. People get it. It's scary. Exactly.
I mean, could you just say, like, time erodes all things, like, once instead of six times? Like, that's all I'm asking here. You don't need to specify that it erodes stone and, like, stars. Hey. And, yeah, hey, I don't know why it's a New Jersey film producer.
Every film producer is a tough New Jersey guy. Hey, make a movies over here like Mama used to do.
Yeah, John Peters, apparently. And could you add a giant spider?
Could you?
Could one of the ghosts be a giant spider? That's all I ask.
Exactly. But like you said, like, I complained about that on a technical level, but I was there for it. I was watching with the same, like, unbroken eye contact, because the acting is beautiful. It's all part of the theme and the slow amble, and it's great.
What I will say, if we're doing the, like, incredibly petty minor complaints about it, I have one as well.
Yes.
Maybe because I don't know if you picked up on it. Maybe it's because you're American or whatever. But, like, there are some seriously questionable accents in this movie, like Amy Adams leap year kind of accents going on here. Darby O'Gill and the Little People. I know it's in Britain, not Ireland, but, like, in particular, like, Henry Thomas, who is great, who's like Henry Wingrave, but is very clearly not a British actor.
This is just for you, because for me, it's like, oh yes, everyone's British or Irish and everything's fine. Like, you know, because I'm an American, I don't know.
Yeah, they talk about tea a lot. That's how I know they're British. But there's a few of those. Like, there's a few of those, like, it primarily Henry Thomas as Henry Wingrave, who's very much like, yeah, so I'm going to narrate here the point of, I'm going to talk about how terribly British all this is, you see. Would you like for some tea, please? And it's not a problem once you get into it, because, again, it feels... Because it's October and because I've been watching lots of, like, old-fashioned kind of, like, horror movies from, like, the 60s. And again, a lot of this draws from stuff like that, like The Innocents and kind of other adaptations of Turning the Screw. So, like, bad British accents are almost, like, par for the course with this. Like, it's almost like... it wouldn't feel like it was a proper tribute to classic horror movies if there wasn't an American doing a very highly questionable British accent. So I'm not complaining too much, but it was a little bit jarring initially, particularly because, like, you have actual British actors in there, like Rahul Kohli, who plays Owen, that sort of stuff. And you compare him with, like, yeah, with Henry James, with, sorry, with, the, yeah, Henry Thomas and stuff like that, or Katie Sagal at points, and it's like, okay, you know, you could not do the accent. I could just accept that you're British. I could just take it at face value. You could just, like, hold a cup of tea or wear, like, a Union Jack t-shirt and I would get it. It's like, it's fine.
Yeah, no, and that, unfortunately, that goes right over my Midwestern American head. Everyone was, oh, and if you say you're from there, I'm with you. Yeah. I'm with you. That's great.
But yeah, so that's really it. I think we managed to talk about avoiding spoilers. I'm not sure if there's anything kind of spoilerific we want to talk about, do we?
There's a couple things that I'd like to talk about. Okay, so I suppose
Heads
up, from now on, this is the last thing we're talking about. Spoilers for The Haunting of Bly Manor. Overall, highly recommend, by the way. If we haven't been very obvious gushing over it for this past half hour. There's just a few things that are spoiler heavy that I would like to talk about. So if you don't want any spoilers, leave now. Thanks for watching or listening.
I think they're going, all right, Jack.
Here's the spoiler. Or, you know, here's the spoiler I'd like to talk about is, as I talked about, I love a person dealing with personal drama, but there's also ghosts. What got very confusing to me is they also mix in metaphorical ghosts into the soup. And that at first you're like, oh, okay, everything's a real ghost. Wait a minute.
Is the boyfriend a ghost? Is the, like,
ex-fiance is not a ghost. That's personal trauma personified as a ghost. Alcoholic Lord Wingrave, his mean self is not a ghost. That is just a personification of a problem. And so it's like the mixture of actual ghosts and visualizations of personal trauma as ghosts did not mesh well with me.
I can kind of see that. I mean, I did kind of get it in the sense of, like, again, this is a, like, we mentioned how heavy the dialogue is. I like the framing of this as, like, the framing, we haven't mentioned the framing device, but the framing device is that they're at a wedding rehearsal dinner. And, like, Carla Guccino, who, now that we can mention, is not just the narrator, she's the older version of the groundskeeper. But, like, I love that she's like, I hope you all enjoyed the wedding rehearsal dinner. Now let's gather around a fire while I tell you a 9-hour-long lesbian ghost love story. And it's like, this is the best wedding rehearsal dinner ever.
Oh, exactly. Yeah.
But, like,
exactly.
Except, like, that kind of framework gives me a bit of leeway with it. And again, a lot of the stuff with the metaphors and stuff like that is as well, like, things like the Peter Quint and the movie kind of, like, implying child abuse and then kind of running away from child abuse and kind of suggesting it and, like, not being entirely clear as to what is and isn't. Is this a metaphor? Is it actually... Like, I didn't mind that stuff so much, so I didn't mind...
Well, yeah, and I think in the Peter Quint case in specific, where it's just, like, he's kind of trapped in his own hell because he never resolved his father's child abuse against him. Yeah. Like, that, I think, worked well. And then, of course, like...
But then him child abusing Miles, basically, as well. Like,
which...
Yeah.
Which is, I think, that because that's how it works, right? Yeah, it's generational. Like, you don't deal with your own trauma. You pass bring it to the next generation. Yeah. Like to me, that fit perfectly within the metaphor, you know. But the ex-fiance was just like, while that was really really fun, spooky atmosphere for the first couple of episodes.
The glasses. I love the light in the glasses. It's
right out of Sin City. Just beautiful.
Elijah Wood. I love the idea that, like, Elijah Wood was the inspiration. It's just,
yes. I mean, it kind of was, right? Yeah. And you know, like, that, and then it's just like, that's her personal trauma. She feels guilty about how she felt towards him, about how she feels towards everything. But then there's also actual ghosts. So that gets muddled.
Yeah.
My only other, like, very spoiler heavy gripe is episode 8, which, while is a fantastic episode of television, also just takes the whole story and says, wait, like, if you are that, you know, old groundskeeper lady telling the story, she goes, I know you're really invested in these characters. We're going to take an hour and I'm going to give you the backstory of all the ghosts now, which is fun backstory. But guess what? We're stopping the story I've been telling you for the last 8 hours.
Yeah, but this is very much the showcase for me as a narrator. You'll notice that my narration is going to get very heavy right about now. I'm just this is the point where I take the themes and I hammer them into your face repeatedly. And I kind of admire that, because, again, I think that the thing with episode 8 was it was originally planned for, like, the Haunting of Hill House, because they wanted to do a backstory for the ghost episode. That didn't happen. And I kind of like that, like, episode 8 is, while nowhere near as, like, visually ambitious as, say, Two Storms, which is the one that shot, like, a series of long takes, this one is more like, fine, we'll do a classic 1960s, 1940s, like, Dracula haunted house movie. We'll shoot it in black and white. We'll use natural lighting. We'll shoot intense close-ups with wide-angle lenses so they blur around the edges, which I really love as well.
Oh, like, it looks gorgeous, absolutely.
It absolutely does. And I kind of like that recursive nature of it, where it's a story within a story. Because, you know, normally, obviously, like, narratively speaking, somebody needs to talk to old Jamie and talk to her about the structuring of her storytelling. Like, she needs to do more work on foreshadowing there. But, like, in terms of this being, like, I feel like there's a moment at the end where, like, I love the moment where the criticism moment where the bride kind of sits down. She's like, now, just want you to know, you set up your story wrong. It's like, I made some notes while you were talking. I had some feedback. Just next time you're running through it, you might want to take some of this on board. So you set it up wrong. You said it was a ghost story. Well, I have it down here as a love story. So just, you know, your call. You're the narrator here. You know what you're doing. But, like, you know, my sister's wedding rehearsal dinner is going to be coming up in a couple of years. So when you crack that one out again, just feel free to run with
just
it.
Just switch. Maybe pepper in episode 8. Intermix that. And that way we get a more natural flow to the story. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But, like, within the context of this being, like, a story that is about stories, and, as you mentioned, about generational trauma, about things reiterating and repeating, I actually really like that about episode 8. Because episode 8 is, like, so much of episode 8 is already repetition of what you've seen in earlier episodes. Things like the covering of the mirror is an action that Danny does repeatedly over the course of the show, even though there's no logical reason. So you get that sense of reiteration there. You get this idea of, kind of, you know, the love story that can't work out or whatever, and the kind of vengeful spirit and the bitterness, and all these themes and ideas that, you know, have already been iterating through the story that we've been told in the 80s. All of a sudden then, you know, kind of go back to this story in, what, the 17th century or the 16th century? Whenever
sure,
it is,
why
the plague,
not?
The plague,
old,
plague
old,
times,
olden
plague,
times,
plague
yeah.
times, yeah. But, like, I kind of like that it's you can get away with it, and again, I cut it a lot of slack because it's very self consciously. Well, I'm telling you a story, so it's a story about stories, and again, like, you can tell that Mike Flanagan is a very big fan of Stephen Moffat. You can very much tell that. And as somebody who is also a big fan of Stephen Moffat, I'm like, I'll give you a pass on this one, Mike.
I suppose. No, and like, I think overall it's very nice. I also really love it, much like in Hill House, when, like, the ghosts are real ghosts. There are rules that surround the ghosts. It's that classic formula. Oh, there's something spooky. Oh, wait, the spooky thing has rules. Wait, the main character hasn't figured out the rules yet. They figured out the rules. Everything's fine. Like, I love that formula. I think it works fantastically well in The Haunting of Bly Manor. It's just that one episode where they put the brakes on everything and to give us the backstory, which is very nice, helps connect things, but
Jack's minor, like, I gotta talk about this in a podcast tomorrow. Can we get with it? Can we get with it? Can we get...
I also thought episode 8 was the final episode, so, you know.
That would have been amazing. It's like, we're not gonna tell you anything about what happens to these 80s characters. It's like, we'll just assume those crazy kids worked it out in their own time. It's like
they all died and everyone died and everything's fine. But no, I think overall, beautiful story. I love the downbeat ending. It hits you right in the gut, and I think it's such a good addition to a Halloween viewing.
It is. And again, like, the thing that I really like about the ending, and now that we're in talking about it, like, full spoiler mode, is that, like, it manages to make a sad ending of a love story kind of happy, because it's like, yep, everybody dies in the end and love never lasts and nothing is permanent, and that should theoretically be heartbreaking. But because this is a ghost story, you know that everybody dying in the end isn't the worst thing that could happen, right? We've had a whole episode telling you what the worst thing that could happen is. So technically, this is, while a downer by most standards, kind of an upper of an ending, really.
Well, it, you know, I mean, Danny still has her face, you know? Danny still has her face. You know, we get that shot of Danny's hand on the groundskeeper's shoulder at the end. The groundskeeper still, like, filling things with water to see the reflection. Hoping that Danny's still there with her. Yeah. Like, love persists beyond death. And, of course, like, the greater meaning of, you know, the children have moved on, are in healthy relationships. The gang is still together, in quote-unquotes, right? As we know, the chef is there at the end. The children are there at the end. The groundskeeper is there at the end. So it's like, it's bittersweet, which is a lovely way to end a horror story.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And a fantastic way to end a podcast, perhaps.
That's exactly. I was hoping we'd get there because we're right at the ticking clock right here. Everybody, thanks so much for watching or listening to this, The Escapist Movie Podcast, this time talking not about movies, only about movie news and television shows.
It's like an 8, it's like a 9-hour movie, right?
But once again, I've been Jack Packard.
I've been Darren Mooney.
And thanks so much. Bye.
Bye.